Well, good morning.
Good morning.
As Helen said, this is a difficult topic, and part of my conclusion is what to do as a church and as individuals that have suffered in a situation of domestic violence, and also as individuals who may want to help or to be support, but don't necessarily know what to do. And as a society, do we know what to do about domestic violence or not? Or in a minute we'll take a look at, does the very nature of our society actually support and affirm domestic violence? You know, our principles, when it says search for truth and meaning, I'm thinking of adding a fearless search for truth and meaning, like in the 12 steps, a fearless search of moral inventory. Sometimes our search for truth and meaning really needs to be fearless. I'm thinking of the march that's going to be next Saturday, Take Back the Night, to bring awareness to domestic violence. And October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And I met with a group of ministers recently, and talked with them and asked them what they were doing as a church and sermon-wise concerning this month being Domestic Violence Month. And they looked at me and said, "What? What do you mean? We follow a pattern." Some did, you know, of sermons prescribed by hierarchy or. No, I did not know that this was an awareness month of domestic violence, and I thought, from the pulpit, what words do we speak? And what are appropriate words about the things of our culture? And horrific stories. Somebody I know dearly and love made me aware of a story and said, "You need to address this in your sermon," and told me the story, and I went, "I don't know if I want to do that." And that was a story about women in prison giving birth whose legs are shackled to the bed as a form of domestic violence. And I at first said, "No, I'm not going to share that," because of my own feelings that come up to me when I think of those words and those images come to my mind, and then I begin to wonder, what kind of society are we that happens in our society in which we participate in, and how is it that we produce people that would participate in those kinds of violent acts that are legal in 39 states in fear of people running and escaping prison while giving birth. But there's something wrong with us as a people. And as a pastoral counselor, I really try to combat and identify negative self-beliefs and engage in a process of transformation for a positive sense of self and positive sense of beliefs. But in studying and reading and my own personal experiences in terms of domestic violence, what is wrong with us is a fair question as a society that this kind of behavior goes on, this kind of attitude toward women. I had the thought yesterday that I could not understand now that women have money, notice the abusive tone that even takes, why they have not bought guns and simply started shooting. I do not understand when we hear stories such as the one I just shared. And I got to thinking, well, what, first of all, how do we approach something that is systemically wrong with the society? Because when I realized that this was a systemic issue, that there really may be nothing we can do to end domestic violence. It may be a cancer that we simply have to live with because of the nature of who we are as a culture. And if that is the conclusion, then what do we do? If that is the conclusion. And so I think to start with, it may be helpful to just try to understand who are we as human beings. First, can we identify who and what are we as human beings? And from my perspective, this is who we are, and it's a total shift in feeling and a total shift in understanding is some of the thoughts that I was sharing. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to have in us a developmental, some would say, genetic schema that unfolds as we go through life, and that part of who we are as human beings is that we are bonding creatures. We are creatures that look for relationships. We are creatures that look for pleasure in relationships, that look for kindness in relationships. It's just who we are. We reach out to one another. We try to find communities. We gather here to try to find like-mindedness. Both Aristotle and Freud, significant figures, positive and negative in many ways, but significant figures in studying human nature, says our first pursuit is happiness, that we do pursue harmony. But yet if we're bonding creatures, if we're creatures that seek relationship, if we're creatures that seek community and be cooperative with one another, that means we seek happiness in relationship. That means we cannot find happiness. Well, that must have been powerful words. We cannot find happiness outside of relationship, yet, by its very nature, domestic violence occurs in relationship. So many of us who seek happiness, who seek comfort, who seek harmony, who seek out what is good for us, we do it in ways that end up in acts of violence that would actually deter what it means to be human. And how do we get caught in that kind of paradox? We seek to be cared for. We seek to care for others. We want to have meaning for ourselves. We want to have meaning for others. We like to play. We engage in play. We watch play. We spend lots of money watching play and playing, as Sunday afternoon will teach us. We are curious people. All these things, that's who we are and what we do in life that are good and that are wonderful. When I was in seminary, I had a similar question, who are we as people? And I've shared, it's been a while, and I'll share it again, that at the core of who we are, I came to the conclusion after reading sacred text that at the core of who we are is that we are blessed, known, good, and loved. And try to encapsulate in a simple way who we are as creatures. And that idea of being blessed has an idea of in a relationship that we are welcomed and that we are welcoming. That idea of good has that we are creative and that we are involved in a creative process. And that we create not just things, but we create our own stories and we create relationships. When we get into relationships, here's an individual. We come together and we create a relationship. And it's a wonderful thing, and it is a good thing. And that sense of being known, that we create an environment where we are emotionally safe, where we are physically safe. And that's our goal. And that sense of being loved, that we can reflect back on our own histories, not just love others, but love ourselves. And that when these things are in motion, what it means to be human can be maximized, our potentials can happen. Anything that gets in the way of that understanding, I'm going to say today, is abusive. You know that was true? Not true. Let there be light. Anything that gets in the way of that is a problem. When things get in the way of our natural expression of who we are as people, we begin to reject ourselves. One of the first ways we protect ourselves in a domestic violence situation is that we begin to reject ourselves. That I have a right to a safe place. That I have a right to a caring relationship. That in my lifetime I'm going to experience a good relationship, a caring relationship. When I'm in a relationship that does not reflect that, I begin to think, what's wrong with me that I don't have this? I can even begin to think, I'm the problem when I am the victim. We reject our very selves and our ideas. I remember years ago I was in a therapy group as the patient, and I was sharing that one time when I was in Sunday school class at 17, I was going to share this idea, but I heard this other voice said, "No, don't share that idea because that's a stupid idea." I don't know if any of you have ever had that happen to you, that you want to share something, that you want to speak something, you want to put words to something. And in essence, it's either neutral or it's okay, or it's just a participatory process. And then your own voice, something in your own head, comes to you and says, "Don't do that. Don't share. Don't participate." You diminish yourself. You diminish the relationship you're in by not expressing yourself. And the therapist looked at me dead in the eye and she says, "That is one of the most evil things I have ever heard." And I went, "That's pretty serious. Because it's inside me. I was being evil to myself." So I had to understand how did that happen, that I began to do that. I learned a term recently, and you'll hear more about it, whether you want to or not, I suppose. It's called universal neurosis. That we humans repress ourselves, repress our ideas in the culture that we're in, and then when we repress ourselves and repress our ideas, that the outcome of repressing that anxiety, it comes out in another form, and that's neurosis. Neurosis being those things that we suffer with, but we're still functional in society. Basically the definition of neurosis. And I got to think, how can I explain what that means? Because I'm going to consider that domestic violence is a form of neurosis, because we as a society have domestic violence, and yet we continue to function. So it's a neurosis, domestic violence. It's driven by an anxiety that's connected to something that's not in the room, something years ago or something that I'm afraid of is driving domestic violence. It's not in the room, but there it is, driving it. It's a neurosis. And I was trying to say, well, how do we get at that? How do we feel that? How can we identify that in the living room? How can I identify that in the church when we're talking? And I turn to the work of Thich Nhat Hanh, a Buddhist monk, who talks about knots. He says that when you're in a relationship, or when you're insulted, or that when you're injured, or that when something happens, you have knots that happen inside you. You can feel the knot. And the knot can crystallize. And when the knot crystallizes, it becomes part of who you are. And I'm saying today that knot, when it becomes part of who we are, and we express ourselves with that knot being crystallized, that's the neurosis. That's the problem. That's the anxiety-driven behavior that I haven't really dealt with yet. And he says the mature sense of spirituality is to be able to identify when that knot begins to form and to counter it. And to put yourself at ease so the knot does not form. How is it all of this has been normalized in our culture? How is it that the subjugation of women has been normalized in our culture? And we begin to ask that question, to try to understand that, to see if it's possible to unravel that tapestry in the narrative of our culture. See, even the winds are against it. When we're children, we don't think, "I'm going to grow up to be somebody that hurts other people." It's not necessarily in my genetic makeup. Something happens. It's enculturated. And it's domestic violence is criminalized, but it's mostly not a felony. It's a misdemeanor. It's often looked the other way. Police officers come, they calm the situation down and move the other way. Some do what needs to be done, and some don't. We can't get
a constitutional amendment passed saying that women are equal to men. Can't do it. We've been trying since the 70s. And my thought was, why is that even an effort? I mean, why is that even there? That we have to have a law that says women are equal to men. Reading in a book, The Creation of Patriarchy, and the author says that Greek philosophy, Greek science, the Hebrew and the Christian text are the mainstays of the idea systems in which Western civilization was created and which is founded. That is us. We are Western civilization. It is who we are. And it says that these systems all took place when the subordination of women was taken for granted, because the time that the subordination of women, that was already in place when Greek science, Greek philosophy, Hebrew thought, Christian thought came into existence. It was already there. It is in the fabric of who we are. When I think of our last principle, we are part of the inherent web of existence of which we are a part. This is part of the inherent web of existence of our culture, of which we are a part. It's okay to subordinate women. It's okay to have laws against women. It's okay to chain women to tables giving birth. Socrates, who thought that being born a woman was a divine punishment, since a woman is halfway between a man and an animal. In the 4th century, I've given myself permission to speak these words from the pulpit, because talk to my minister friends, they're not speaking these words. And I know that in recovery from domestic violence or any kind of violence, having a witness is paramount. If there's no witness to validate, to process the problem, the recovery doesn't happen. I'll begin to question my own reality. Did he hit me? Did this happen? Did this abuse happen the next day and the next day and the next day? I'll begin to question the reality of it unless there's a witness there that says, yes, this is what happened. You have spoken the truth. This is crucial that you understand this is the truth. Churches, pulpits, people in positions of authority need to say, yes, this is a reality and we need to witness it. The march next Saturday is a witnessing of the reality of domestic violence that is not addressed by many authorities in our culture. In the 4th century, Augustine, a church theologian, he could not understand how a woman could be of help for a man. We'll get to the second part of that, but let's just stay with the first part of that. The assumption is that the woman is there to help the man. That's just the assumption. That is to begin with, not even questioned. Other than childbearing, what good, woman, what good is she? A major theologian upon which the church is based, Thomas Aquinas, reaffirmed the thinking of Socrates, Aristotle, and we did not really begin as Western civilization to fight this in a forceful way until the suffrage movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Margaret Fuller, the Transcendental Movement, Emerson, the Unitarian Universalist, many of them began to fight and say, no, this is not okay. So we ask ourselves, okay, that's the history and it's in our foundation. What are other ways that this is expressed today? How is this expressed today? Article that I recently read about 2 days ago about health insurance companies, and this person says, have waged war against women and people who need them the most. said that women who have breast cancer, lymphoma, and over 1,000 conditions like acne and pregnancy, these people are canceled from their health insurance policy, about $20,000 a year, which saves insurance companies $300 million. 79% of the women in individual market policies do not have any maternal coverage and cannot get it. One insurance representative's official said pregnancy is a matter of choice, so you can't get it. C-sections, and my son was born with a C-section, and believe me, it was a necessary thing, is it called a pre-existing condition. So that is not paid for. Insurance companies also charge women 48% more than men when they get it as an individual and not as a group. There is a process called gender rating. Gender rating. It seems to me we have not come very far from Socrates, from Aristotle, from the Greek philosophy, from considering women as not as worth, important, I don't even know the word, as men. So domestic violence continues. And what are we to do? What are we to do as a people? I could say, man, I'll be glad when October's done and I have fulfilled my responsibility of addressing a difficult topic and look at these things, and I won't have to look at it or think about it for another whole year, and I'll be better than the other ministers because they don't even think about it at all. At least I brought it up. Sure, then we can forget about it and let it go on. I will hope some of you will not let that happen, because now you know that it is woven into the tapestry of who we are as a people. That means it's woven into the tapestry of Gregory Wilson's personality. That means it's woven into the tapestry of who you are. That means it's woven into the tapestry of women. Woven into the tapestry of men. That means we are weaving it into the tapestry of the developmental process of our children. It is there. It is in us. And how are we to do something about it? We could say it's the absence of good, which I agree. We can see it in relationships when there's an absence of affirmation of the other person. We can see it in relationships when there's affirmation of who the other person is as a separate being. We can see it in the absence of legislation. We can see it in the absence of law enforcement. It is the absence of good. So how can we participate in the recovery? Not just thinking about society and how it's woven into society and addressing that and speaking to that and identifying the ways in which domestic violence is, it is part of us and part of our culture. And yes, we need to point a finger to that. We need to say something about it. And we need to identify it. And we need to work on it. And I need to work how it's interwoven into sermons. I need to work how it's interwoven in the ministry of the church so I can work against that and have that not be part of who we are unconsciously. Certainly. How can we make this place a safe place for somebody struggling with those events in their life, whether they were historical or whether they are present? How can we struggle with, how can we provide a safe place that when we want to say something, a voice in my own head says, don't say it, that sounds stupid. Don't say it, somebody else is saying something. Don't say it. That I'm actually committing domestic violence to myself. How can I provide a place to deal with that in this church? How can we provide a place to deal with, as a congregation within these walls, to create an emotionally safe place to deal with those issues? And how can we be a voice in this community that says, this is part of who we are as a people and no more? We will provide a place of which we can talk about this and to support people who are struggling with these issues. Thursday night, we're creating a time for support for persons who are struggling with these issues. Saturday, we're going to be a part of a march. December 5th, we're going to have a seminar to do these kind of things. But my fear is it will drop after that. This is one of the issues that we have to put a voice in our head that says, no, we are not going to let this drop. If the minister is not talking about it, not offering support services for this, I'm going to get into the minister's face and I'm going to talk to him about it. If the minister's talking about it and nothing else is happening, I'm going to go talk to the president about it. I'm going to go talk to the board about it. We're going to do something, but it will take energy from you to do something. But be clear. This is happening in our neighborhood and in our community. It cannot not be happening. What else can we do? We can look inside ourselves before we speak and to make sure that when we speak, we are speaking with kind words. We are expressing love toward one another. We are expressing care toward one another. We are available to receive care. That we are not going to pretend to be ignorant of what's happening around us. And we will move in a direction of kindness and pull ourselves together so that we can be a voice against this evil. And we can facilitate the unfolding of the spiritual life and potentializing of what it means to be human in our church. We can do that.